On a Wednesday, welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm cold. And I'm Avi Wolfman Arrett. It really is cold.
Yes,
by the way.
Is.
Enough with that already.
Mm-hmm. I have a turtleneck. I've been wearing them every day.
I'm wearing a little peach-colored sweater. It says SEPTA on it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're all bundled up. And that has nothing to do with the show today, but it does explain why my brain is functioning at only about 75% capacity. So the show today, Cherry, is about the bird flu.
Yes, it is.
You've been hearing burblings about the bird flu probably for a while now. We thought it would be nice to take a break and sort of address where the spread of bird flu is right now compared to past outbreaks, but also to take a look at where it could be headed. Pennsylvania, by the way, ranks fourth nationally in egg production. There are five states that produce nearly half of all the eggs in the country, according to the trade association that tracks all of this. And Pennsylvania is one of the big five. So bird flu and the impact on egg production really does hit Pennsylvania very hard. So we thought it was worth an episode. And we want to know, very basically, what are your questions about the bird flu? Are you worried about the spread of the bird flu? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. Email studio2@whyy.org. Or hey, if you're watching on YouTube and you're a Studio Tuber, you can drop your comment in the live chat.
Yeah, I will say that the alarm sort of sounded for me last week when we talked about the nearly 500,000 chickens across 9 commercial flocks in Delaware that had to be killed in order to stop the spread. I was like, that's a lot of chickens to be killed. So I really was like, wow, should we be paying it? We should definitely be paying attention to this. And that number is like 1.2 million if you think about the whole Delmarva area. So I started like some alarms started going off in my head like this is probably going to be a thing, or maybe could be a thing. And that's what we're going to talk about today.
It passed your alarm threshold.
Yeah, it did. It did. I started paying attention.
Lots of alarms going off in Abington Township, Jenkintown area recently. We wanted to address that as one of our trio of local news stories. Mm-hmm. Cherry, start us off.
Yes. Well, Abington Township declared a disaster emergency in the wake of that massive fire that started at the SPS Technologies building on Monday night. The DEP and EPA, they are monitoring air quality and thus far have found no chemicals of concern. So let me explain what happened. It all started Monday night with an explosion at the SPS building I mentioned. It was followed by a 4-alarm fire, thick smoke that lasted well into Tuesday. The company is an aerospace parts supplier. They had around 60 workers on site at the time, and no one, of course, was injured, thank goodness. But there were air quality concerns at the time, and it led authorities to issue a shelter-in-place order for a 1-mile radius around that factory. They later recommended evacuation for about 250 homes in Jenkintown. That order and recommendation was lifted as of 11 a.m. this morning. Abington Police Chief Patrick Malloy says the area is now secure. Take a listen.
We have had no concerns about safety, looting. A couple questions came in like that, but it's not happening here in Abington or in Jenkintown because we have everybody coming to help us. So we have enough police personnel. I know our fire personnel are tired, but we have reinforcements coming in.
Yeah, so everybody's going back into their homes now. Officials say that SPS's sprinkler system was out of service for maintenance at the time of the fire, but precautions like a fire watch and fire brigade had been in place.
Yeah, and this is a legacy employer in that area. So there's certainly some concern about that. This company dates back over 100 years.
Mm-hmm. 1903,
I don't know if this is irony or not, because I always forget the official definition of irony, but you mentioned the sprinkler systems at SPS. Back in 2016, there were concerns that SPS had discharged some chemicals into a nearby creek.
Yeah.
And in that case, it was because they were doing maintenance to their sprinkler system. That was apparently the cause of the discharge. And now there's again concerns about this same creek and chemical discharge. So interesting, we're back in the same place. And it's all revolving around these sprinkler systems 8 years apart.
Yeah.
I'm not like making any conspiracy theories. I'm just saying it was just interesting to me that those two things happened over the course of 8 years. But I would imagine that area is super concerned about the fact that this large long-term employer has had its entire facility destroyed.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Congresswoman Madeline Dean says that that building is a total loss. And you mentioned it. They've had some other violations, EPA violations, workplace violations at this building. So I'm sure there will be some form of investigation.
To New Jersey now, where applications for handgun permits are soaring. We got this story from the New Jersey Monitor, and it is fascinating. So applications in New Jersey have just hit a record high, over 4,000 in the month of January. That easily clears the old record. Now, these numbers have been ticking up for a while, and this all tracks back to 2022. There was a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that forced New Jersey to change its permitting laws. And since then, in the 2.5 years since this ruling, there have been 61,000 handgun applications in New Jersey. In the 2.5 years before the ruling, 1,500.
Wow.
So this change in laws has really changed the state of play in terms of handgun permitting and ownership in New Jersey. Historically, in New Jersey, gun ownership rates are very, very low compared to other states. So this is a big sea change for the state of New Jersey.
And what was so interesting about, because I kind of followed that Supreme Court case, you had to justify, you know, or explain why you needed a gun outside of the house in order for you to get the concealed carry permit. The Supreme Court case said you don't have to explain it now. And it limited how New Jersey limited.
My explanation is I want it.
And it limited the reasons that New Jersey could deny your application. And the other thing that stood out to me about this story from the New Jersey Monitor is that law enforcement predicted that they would get around 200,000 concealed carry license applications the year after that SCOTUS decision, three times more than they got.
Yeah.
So, you know,
it didn't meet their predictions.
It didn't meet their predictions.
It was a big change.
But it's still a big change. It's still a lot more than they had, but not as many as they expected.
Yeah. It was a big change, just not as big a change as they expected. I guess the question now is why just in this past month, in the month of January,
is it spiking up?
Yeah. Because we said there were about 4,200 applications in January. I believe the prior record was around 3,200.
Yeah, that's a big
change
spike.
For that related to political events, something else. I actually don't know.
Yeah, interesting.
But something to track. All right, third story, also in the state of New Jersey, also having to do with laws in a way. It does not have to do with handguns.
No.
That's the big difference.
This one has to do with chickens.
Oh,
and,
okay.
Yeah, there's an ongoing legal battle over chickens that's happening. Lori Smith, she lives in Gloucester County and is fighting with her homeowners association. Apparently, she has 5 emotional support chickens, and she has PTSD, and it causes anxiety and panic attacks. And so she got these chickens, and they bring her joy. They bring her peace. They stop her panic attacks. But her HOA says that the neighbors are complaining. And Lori says, you know, look, the neighbors had chickens before, and a board member from the HOA told her it was okay. And so there's been this legal battle going on, and a judge had ruled that the chickens are barnyard animals, not emotional support animals, and they have been fining her $50 a day from until she removes those chickens from her backyard.
I don't understand. How does the law determine whether something is an emotional support animal? That seems genuinely
tricky.
And she
did provide all kinds of, you know, medical
information. Because any
information,
animal
yeah.
could, you know, provide you comfort. Your relationship to that animal is a very individualized relationship.
Yeah.
So you're a lawyer. Like, how would the law go about determining whether something is emotional support or not emotional support?
I guess they would base it on whatever I would think that it would be based on expert testimony.
Yeah.
And so I don't know what the judge, if they just thought this was insufficient, but they've been fining her $50 a day. She has a spot fund page and has crowdfunded about more than $4,000 to help her pay these fees. And now, according to her latest update on that spot fund page, the judge has upped the fine to $100 a day till she gets rid of those. And by the way, those chickens are cute. A couple of them look like roosters.
What?
Yeah, they have the red at the top of the
chickens.
Yeah, they're chickens. Oh, I mean, you know, but that's what they said. They call them chickens, but she has pictures of them.
Are you
saying
that they're not chickens? You're debating, you're questioning whether they're
chickens. I'm wondering why the neighbors are complaining, because the reporting doesn't say why the neighbors are so upset. But one of them looked like a rooster to me.
So you think it's making noise.
Maybe it's making some noise, but I don't know. I have not seen this. I was not entered the backyard. But people are, you know, they've helped her raise around $4,500.
By the way, in New Jersey, you can have a raccoon, a hedgehog, a boa snake, a poison dart frog, a wallaby, or a kinkajou if you have a permit.
Wow.
Actually, there's far more than
that. She needs some permits for these chicks.
That's from the Courier Post.
But it's bird flu, so that could cause a problem.
And that is the topic today. When we come right back on Studio 2, talking bird flu.
Each morning, it's a new opportunity, a chance to start fresh. Up First from NPR makes each morning an opportunity to learn and to understand. Choose to join the world every morning with Up First, a podcast that hands you everything going on across the globe and down the street, all in 15 minutes or less. Start your day informed and anew with Up First by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. If you took a look at eggs on your last trip to the supermarket, you may have noticed a very high price tag. Eggs have become more expensive across the U.S. And H5N1, also known as bird flu, is to blame. Millions of chickens have died or been killed in an effort to contain the virus. The CDC also confirmed the illness in other wild birds, cows, cats, and so far around 70 human cases, resulting in one death.
And there is concern that without a swift response, we could be headed toward a bird flu pandemic among humans. So should we be avoiding eggs and other poultry products? How worried should we be overall? We're going to get the latest on H5N1 today and answer all of your questions. Joining us remotely right now is Lena Sun. She's a health reporter at the Washington Post who focuses on public health and infectious disease. Lena Sun, welcome to Studio 2.
Nice to be there with you.
Yes, and for you, our listeners, today we want to know, are you concerned about the spread of bird flu? Has the rise in egg prices changed anything about your grocery habits? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And for those of you watching on WHYY's YouTube channel, be sure to drop your questions or comments in the live chat.
And I see from that chat and from some comments on our screen, a lot of you have questions about the administration's response to this outbreak. But before we get to all of that, Lena Sun, when did this outbreak really emerge, and what differentiates it from past bird flu episodes? Because this is something that's kind of always seemingly burbling in the background, but what differentiates what's happening right now?
So this particular strain of bird flu virus has been around since 2022, and it killed a lot of chickens. If you remember, egg prices went up very much around that time. But what really got people worried and made the hairs on the arms of epidemiologists stand up was in early last year, 2024, in March, when it was detected for the first time in dairy cows. This is a domesticated animal. We have a lot of cows. Cows produce milk, and there are a lot of people who are in close contact with cows. And it was the first time it had been seen in cows. And it has now spread through dairy herds in the United States. It's in at least 16 states, close to 1,000 herds. And from the cows, it has also infected humans. It's also spilled back over into poultry and into cats. And what's unusual is it doesn't make the cows that sick, but when this virus gets into poultry, it kills them very quickly. And that's why we have such a high price of eggs, because the hens that lay eggs, all the poultry when it infects the poultry flocks, they have to kill all of the birds to make sure to get rid of the virus. So no hens, fewer eggs, higher prices for eggs. And in humans, so far, most of the dairy workers have had mild illnesses and they have recovered. But in the case of one man in Louisiana, who was older and had underlying medical conditions, he was infected. He had exposure to backyard flocks on his property, and he did die. He was the first bird flu death in the United States.
Wow.
And this same strain of bird flu virus infected a teenager in Canada, and the 13-year-old was in the hospital for over 2 months. She was on all of this intensive care. She was lucky to be alive because she was able to get to a really good children's hospital.
Wow. It sounds like, those are very concerning. What has been the response from the Centers for Disease Control or from, our government?
So since March of last year, it's been across the board. Part of this is because you have cows, which are regulated by the USDA. You have milk, which is regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. And you have, making sure people don't get sick. That's the CDC. So you have a lot of federal agencies playing in the sandbox. And the missions of these agencies is not always the same. It's the USDA's job to promote trade and business. And industry has been reluctant since last year to do more testing of cows and more testing of milk that before it gets pasteurized. And you have a little bit of a clash there because from the farmer's point of view, they don't want to be known as to be having a herd that has cows infected with H5N1, because then they are worried that the processors are not going to buy their milk. They don't buy their milk, the farms, can't make a living. And on the other side, the CDC has said, well, we are not going to just randomly test everybody. We are going to test people who have symptoms. But you have to think about it. The people on the farms are perhaps there's going to be a large percentage of undocumented workers. If you are getting sick with bird flu and it does not make you that sick, are you going to risk not going to work and not getting paid, or are you going to go to work? Mm-hmm. So it is harder to reach folks. There are a lot of complicating issues to sort of let people know about the risks. If you are a dairy farm worker and you are working with cows, you have risk of getting bird flu. But we also have a lot of seasonal flu, right? Everybody you know has flu. That's the regular flu season. We're a very high flu season. And I'm sure your next guest could explain it more, the virology. But if I'm a person and I have regular flu, but then I get infected with H5N1, the two strains of the virus can mix. They can exchange genetic material to create another version that is more lethal and could be more transmissible. And that's what people are worried about. And that's what could seed a pandemic.
Mm. Wow. Greg says, I'm concerned the Trump administration and the RFK Jr.-led HHS will be even more complacent and incompetent than the first Trump administration was in the early days of the COVID-19 pandemic. I fear there won't be another Operation Warp Speed like the one that ended up being so successful in 2021. We need vaccines for both animals and people, and we need them now. Vaccines. Where do they enter into the equation here, and when should they be used, according to experts?
So there is a sort of an experimental poultry vaccine that just got licensed by the USDA. But traditionally, in the United States, the industry doesn't want to vaccinate the chickens because they're worried if you vaccinate your chicken, it's going to mask the virus, and that's going to make it harder to export your poultry overseas. So they have been working on trying to use what they call biosecurity measures to contain the virus. If you go on the farm, you have to, you have to walk through, a pan of bleach and change clothing and make sure you don't spread. But the problem with this bird flu virus is, wild birds have the virus. They fly down from the sky. If you have all your cage-free, roaming around chickens out there and another bird, the wild birds come by, drop their feces, drop their urine. It's hard to control what's coming down from the sky, right? Yeah. And on the human side, there have been vaccine candidates that the government has developed to could be turned into a vaccine for humans if needed. But, we're also living in a time when I think many people feel like, look what happened with the COVID vaccine. People don't want to get it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't even get the flu vaccine, even though it will prevent you from getting really, really sick.
Yeah, it's a tough sell for sure.
Yeah. Tough sell.
And I got to ask you this, because if the bird flu started spreading among humans tomorrow, do you think that our government would be ready to respond?
That is what they are supposed to be doing, right? But it's hard to think about that level of response if most of the executive orders coming out of the White House are about cutting staff at the federal health agencies, and also you don't hear a coherent strategy for how they want to tackle this. I'm not sure if the president has mentioned even the words bird flu. I think he talked about egg prices before he was elected, but you know, those two are connected.
Right.
And his new USDA secretary has wanted to focus on biosecurity. I think she said something on Fox in a Sunday interview that she didn't want to kill as many chickens, you know, so that people wouldn't affect the food supply, and that she wanted to use more biosecurity. And, you know, you got to let the public health and the experts tell you what to do. We need, if you know where the virus is, then you can do more to contain it. But if you don't know where it is, it can spread silently. And we have studies showing that vets who take care of cows, there was a study that I wrote about last week, they did not knowingly work with herds that were infected, and yet they had antibodies for the virus, which means they did get sick, but they were working with animals that were so supposedly not sick.
Yeah. And I got to ask you a quick follow up, because the Trump administration accidentally, according to reports, fired key personnel that would be involved in the bird flu response. What do you think the impact of those firings could be, knowing what you know about the federal government agencies and some of the tensions that are kind of happening between the agencies?
Well, I think they realized that it was a mistake, and it's like, whoops, we're going to try to put them back. And those folks were working at a national animal laboratory that USDA runs, because they check the samples and test. I don't know. These cuts don't seem to be made with like a scalpel. You know, they're like an axe just goes across. And in the interest of a government efficiency and government, you know, less spending. But a lot of the folks who do the technical behind the scenes work are working to keep Americans safe across the federal government, especially at the CDC. They're the people who go out and respond to outbreaks. They have a fellowship program where the laboratory scientists are helping figure out how the, you know, responding to various outbreaks. And you cannot cut public health and expect that if the next pandemic comes, that we'll just be able to respond.
We have a couple comments here that are related, and I wanted to sort of mash them together for you as one question. So Angela on YouTube asks, is this primarily affecting mass production chicken farms? And Lily asks, we have noticed our egg prices double and triple, but not the price of the chicken we buy from the same store. Why isn't the impact as big on meat prices? So it's kind of a twofer, like what types of production facilities are being hardest hit, but then also what types of food supplies are being hardest hit and why?
Well, let me just say this. People should not be drinking raw milk or be eating any kind of raw milk product, cheeses or whatever. I mean, you have some folks in Pennsylvania who like to eat that kind of stuff. Milk that's pasteurized is heated at a certain temperature and it inactivates the virus. This virus has been hard hit on the egg laying facilities, egg laying farms. So when you got to destroy all of your egg laying hens, you have fewer eggs, and it takes a while for them to grow them back up.
Is that just because of the way they're farmed? Like why those particular types of farms are being
Exactly sure, because I'm not deep into the poultry farm. I know more about dairy cows now because I spent 3 days at the Iowa State Fair and hung out in the cattle barn with all the farmers for a long time. But the egg laying facilities have been hard hit. I don't know if it's because of the way they're designed or because of the hens are more vulnerable.
Interesting.
But the chickens, you know, the reason you can have chickens is you don't have to worry about the virus in the chickens, because anytime the chickens are infected, they're killed.
Yeah.
So nobody's selling, you know, marketing, you know, diseased chickens. We think that the egg prices will continue to stay high because it takes a while for the farms to bring the stock back. But hopefully, maybe this maybe will abate by later in the summer.
Yeah. Well, we want to wrap up our conversation with you. My last question to you, Lena, is how worried should the average person be?
I think the average person still should not be too worried. The risk to the average person is low. But if you're a vet or you're a farm worker or you're going to have a lot of interaction with these animals, obviously you're getting a higher risk.
Yeah.
But remember, you know, if you have a backyard flock of chickens, those are, you know, some of the people who've gotten sick, including this last person in Wyoming, this woman who's hospitalized, she was infected because she's exposed to backyard chickens.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are turning to flocks to do that, but you have to be careful also.
Yeah,
a good note of caution. That's Lena Sun, health reporter at the Washington Post, who focuses on public health and infectious disease. Lena, great information. Thank you for being with us on Studio 2.
Thank you.
And now we want to bring in a local business person who's been affected by all of this. This is John Knocklinger, who is the CEO of the Bad Cookie Company based in Princeton, New Jersey. They're dealing with rising egg costs. John, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you for having me.
So give us a sense of how prices have changed at your business and why.
Well, first, your prior guest, I was glad to hear that they might go down at some point soon. So that was a good thing to hear. But our prices of eggs have gone up on average, I would say, about 30 to 40% over the last about 6 months.
Wow.
It sort of depends on where we purchase the eggs from. And sometimes, fortunately, we're able to get them a little bit cheaper for a number of reasons. But on average, it's been about 30 to 40% more for us.
Wow. And it sounds like you had to pass those prices along. How has that impacted prices of the products you make? And what has been the customer response?
Well, we haven't wanted to raise our prices permanently because we're hopeful that the cost will abate at some point. So we have been instituting a 25-cent per cookie surcharge for eggs right now so that hopefully when the price comes down, we can just get rid of that. And fortunately, because it's been widely known that this issue has been going on, our customers have not been upset by it. They've mm-hmm. understood that we are just passing along our added cost to them. We're not making any extra money from it. We're just trying to maintain where we were before the eggs went up in price. So I'm hoping that we're going to be able to get rid of that surcharge by some point this year.
Yeah, you mentioned being surprised by what Lena said. So I guess your suppliers are not telling you that the prices are about to go down. You're not, there's not a lot, you're just sort of seeing the prices as they come in here.
Yeah, because I think there's a lot of uncertainty about when and if the prices are going to come down. I mean, the prices on everything have been going up over the past couple of years. So it's just the egg spike price has really been shocking to the system, you know, because everything else, as it's gradually gone up in price, we've gradually increased our prices slightly to keep up with it.
Yeah.
It's just this spike has just been caught everyone off guard.
Before we let you go, it can't all be bad news. So, John, mm-hmm. tell us a little bit about like a great product you have at your store. Let's do a little advertising here for Bad Cookie Company in Princeton, New Jersey. What's the best thing on the menu?
Oh, the best thing on the menu is our cookie called Butter My Pea. It's a peanut butter and milk chocolate chip cookie. It's delightful. We use only Ghirardelli milk chocolate chips. We're very proud of our cookies. No fluff, no frosting, just good old-fashioned, really large chocolate chip-based cookies. So we're very happy to bring our product to all over the New Jersey and basically Eastern Pennsylvania area, and we hope to continue to do that for many years to come.
Well, that sounds like a good cookie, not a bad cookie.
And it sounds like it's good. A good thing is the customers there are willing to pay the 25% a cookie, you know, increase in price because they sound so good.
I want to thank you, John. Yeah, go ahead.
No, yeah, absolutely. And it's good that we have really great customers that understand that, you know, sometimes businesses have to add these costs when things are out of our control.
Well, that's John Knocklinger, CEO of the Bad Cookie Company based in Princeton, New Jersey. And thanks for joining us today to give us a little bit of a local lens on how this is affecting folks in our community. John, appreciate the time on Studio 2.
My pleasure.
Yes, and coming up, we're talking to a virologist about bird flu and its potential to become a pandemic. Are you worried about the bird flu? Chime in. The number is 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, be sure to leave your question or comment in the live chat. We'll see you right after the break. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Checking the YouTube live chat right now. Everyone says go to Wegmans for your eggs, apparently. That's wow. The hack. We've been talking about the impact of the bird flu on farms and consumers, with millions of chickens dying from bird flu and egg shortages driving those prices right up. Now we want to take a break and talk about the virus itself, H5N1. There have been around 70 cases of bird flu infections in humans. Certainly concern it could be spreading more widely than has been detected. Lena Sun talked about that CDC study on just that fact. So could the bird flu turn into a human pandemic? How virulent is this virus? Are we prepared to combat it?
Yeah, and our guest is virologist Angela Rasmussen with the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Angela, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yes, and our question for you, our listeners, is this. Are you worried about the bird flu? Is it on your radar? Call us, 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you are watching on WHYY's YouTube channel, you can drop your comments or questions in the live chat. So, Angie, I want to start with you because I want to start with this question. We heard how this bird flu is a little bit different. It's spread not just among birds, but it's in cattle. It's come back to poultry, and now we've seen it in humans. One person has died. Another young person got really, really ill. What's the science behind this sort of spread and going from different types of species? Can you explain that to us?
Yeah, I can try. There's still a lot of unknowns about this particular H5N1 virus, but in general, influenza viruses are pretty flexible. They can get into a lot of different species. Now, historically, H5N1 has been largely limited to birds, although there have been spillovers, that's transmission to another species, including humans. But this particular H5N1, which has been causing a panzootic, which is a pandemic in animals, since 2021, came over to North America at the end of 2021 and began infecting birds here. In the course of that, it's actually also infected a ton of other wild species. So we've found things like grizzly bears, raccoons, foxes. We've all heard now that domestic cats can also be infected. Along the coast of South America in 2023, there was actually a huge die-off of sea lions that was also caused by a version of this particular H5N1. And last December, December of 2023 in Texas, there was a single spillover event from a bird to a cow. That one spillover event triggered the cattle outbreak, which has now infected almost 1,000 herds in 17 states across the US. And it has spread very, very efficiently through these cows. We don't completely understand why this particular virus seems to be so good at infecting all these different mammals, but it does seem to be very flexible about crossing species barriers. And that is why it does present a significant pandemic risk, because as you pointed out, it has also infected quite a few humans.
So you said it was that one jump to a dairy cow that triggered this whole outbreak among dairy cows. So if there was an event that triggered human-to-human spread, would it be that simple? Would it be sort of like one mutation somewhere and then all of a sudden, you know, the proverbial cat's out of the bag?
So it could be, but actually that's not the most likely scenario. And to talk about this, we need to understand a little bit of influenza biology.
All right, break it down.
So Influenza is a segmented virus. That means that its RNA, the genetic material that encodes the virus, is divided up into eight different segments or eight pieces. Now, when an influenza virus, like such as H5N1, infects a host, any host, it will start to replicate. If that host also gets infected with another influenza virus, and in this case, a seasonal human-adapted influenza virus strain, those segments will be all being generated in the same cell. And when the new baby viruses come out of that cell, it will contain a mix of those different segments. It's almost like shuffling two decks of cards together. This process is called reassortment. And in addition to mutation, which does happen with influenza viruses, reassortment is a mechanism that allows flu viruses to make these large evolutionary leaps forward in a very short period of time. And it does matter what species that this reassortment occurs in, but unfortunately there are two species that are extremely high risk for reassortment with human seasonal strains, that is humans and also pigs. So far, we don't have a lot of evidence that there has been widespread pig infection, so that's good. On the other hand, we have a lot of infected humans for H5N1. This is a historic peak in the US. And we also have peaking levels of seasonal influenza of two different subtypes, H1N1 and H3N2. The possibility of reassortment is very high because actually there is now a third severe influenza patient in Colorado who is being hospitalized, presumably at a facility that also has a lot of seasonal influenza patients. So this is something that is a really, really significant concern. And it's something that myself and all of my colleagues are watching for, because the last three out of the four pandemics that have occurred have been the result of a recent reassortment event.
Can I just clarify something real quick? So every time a human gets this virus and has some other flu virus, this shuffling is happening. What you're saying is that shuffling has not happened in an order, in a way that creates the conditions for human to human transmission that we know of yet.
That's correct.
But every time you shuffle, that possibility is there.
That possibility is there. And the problem with reassortment is that it's incredibly unpredictable.
Yeah.
So you've got a flu virus that has eight segments that's adapted to people. And then you have this one that's adapted to birds, but is okay at replicating in mammals. What combination of those eight segments is going to result in something that can go human to human? We actually don't know that, unfortunately. So we've been monitoring different mutations. We have been monitoring reassortants which have occurred throughout this pandemic. And in fact, the cow virus was a recent reassortment in birds, cross species into cows. So this is actually something that happens fairly frequently with influenza viruses, especially if there's a lot of them around. Unfortunately, it doesn't happen so often that we can automatically predict what's going to happen when it does.
Yeah. And I want to invite you, our listeners, to chime in. Are you concerned or worried about the bird flu? Is it even on your radar? Do you have questions? You can call 888-477-9499. You can email studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on our YouTube channel, you can drop your questions or comments in the chat. And so, Angie, my question to you is, as a virologist, what are you looking for? What would be the clues that we've crossed the line into a place where human-to-human spread of H5N1 is happening more than it is right now?
Right. So right now we have no evidence that human to human transmission is happening. I want to be very clear about that. All of the human cases are thought to be zoonotic transmission from either a bird or a cow. So that's good. But there's some bad news here, and some of it is context dependent. The way that you would find human to human transmission is by doing a lot of testing. Because one thing we do know about these viruses, and there's actually multiple genotypes of H5N1 circulating, so there's a couple different H5N1 viruses that we're thinking about here. But these viruses don't actually seem to cause severe disease, at least in the dairy and poultry workers that are predominantly getting them. So that means that in order to identify cases, we'd actually need to be doing a lot of sensitive molecular diagnostic testing. Unfortunately, because of the current political situation, we've now seen the CDC taking huge losses in terms of people who would be responding to emerging outbreaks. We have seen expertise get cut from basically every agency at the Department of Health and Human Services, And we've also learned that the USDA laid a bunch of people off. They're responsible for testing cows and chickens. And some of those people were working on bird flu and they're trying to hire them back now. So yeah. while we would yeah. normally use testing to try to find evidence of human to human transmission, right now I'm not sure that we actually have that capacity. And that's really scary because without testing, the only way that we would necessarily know that human to human transmission had started was when enough people have become infected that that small percentage that's going to get severely ill starts filling up hospitals.
And let me ask
you, at that point, it's too late to contain.
Let me ask you a quick follow-up question, because one of the things I think most people don't know is even how does it present? Because I saw that in the case, one of the human cases, people had pink eye. They had no idea that they had bird flu or even that it was so serious that they should even get a physician's help. What are some of the symptoms that people should pay attention to, especially if they're dealing with, you know, birds?
Yeah, that's a fantastic question, Cherry. And some of this is a little bit unknown. So it looks like a lot of the conjunctivitis cases, are occurring through direct exposure of raw milk or handling birds and then touching your face. So that may be an issue of infection route. It also may be that some people, different age groups, different health status are differently susceptible to different levels of disease severity from this. But the classic symptoms of H5N1 and the ones that people really need to look out for in terms of severe illness is respiratory disease. So it has long been thought that one of the reasons that H5N1 can infect people and make them very sick, but not transmit efficiently, is that the receptor, the molecule that allows that virus to enter the cell, for the bird viruses is only found deep in the lungs. So if you inhale enough virus, you get enough down there to actually cause an infection, you basically instantly have viral pneumonia. And that's very serious. But if you don't inhale as much virus, and there are these receptors on the conjunctiva or the cornea of the eye, then maybe you get a more localized infection. It's not as serious. Maybe you get a sort of mild respiratory symptoms, but you don't end up having this severe viral pneumonia. Mm. And so that's kind of what people should be looking out for. Conjunctivitis, certainly. But if they start having severe respiratory symptoms, they really should go seek medical treatment. And if they've been in contact with animals, they should let their provider know that.
We have a lot of sort of practical questions from listeners. Mm-hmm. I want to get to those rapid fire in a second, but real quick. Going back to something you said earlier, if we know that lots of people are in close contact with animals who could be infected and that lots of people also have seasonal flu, is this just a matter of time before the wrong mutation happens? Or is there like a real possibility that this mutation never happens and we never have human to human spread on a wide scale?
Both of those things are possibilities. And Avi, this is what is so unsatisfying about this. Because we could have a flu pandemic that starts tomorrow, or we could have one that never starts.
Yeah.
I think, though, that because of the prevalence of seasonal flu in the human population, if this is going to turn into a pandemic, at least this flu season, I think the greatest likelihood of that is probably within the next month or two that that would happen. And then maybe we have a reprieve. I mean, that's not a guarantee, but maybe we have a reprieve until the next flu season. And assuming that we don't get the outbreak in cows and birds under control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all likelihoods, right? It's probabilities. It's likelihoods. It's like you said, it's not satisfying, but it's the truth.
Yeah. I want to get to some of our listener questions. Ellen asks, am I at risk if I have a lot of bird feeders in my yard and I refill them weekly? Your advice to someone like Ellen who feeds their birds and may come in contact with these feeders.
Yeah, so that's a great question. I've actually been asked this by a lot of people who like bird watching, bird feeding, and some people actually have birds that they've trained to eat out of their hands. And for all of those activities, there are clear risk mitigation steps that you can take. So changing bird feeders once a month or once a week is actually not a super high risk, especially if there's not birds hanging around those feeders while you're doing it. It is still, however, a risk. So with that, You might want to consider wearing respiratory protection. You also would definitely want to wash your hands after handling that before you touch your face or before you touch any other animals in your household.
I have a question here from JA, one of our YouTube commenters, who says, how long can the virus survive in food stored at room temp? Specifically wondering if I store raw, freeze-dried cat food for several months, if the risk of illness could be eliminated. So food storage tips, Angie.
Yeah, so that's a question that I don't know the answer to, especially with regard to cat food. Now, viruses can remain infectious under different conditions, and it's not just temperature, but it's humidity as well and exposure to sunlight. So it's really, really difficult to give a precise time period for that. But I do want to say that particularly with raw cat food or freeze-dried cat food that hasn't been heated through, it is really important that people err on the side of caution before feeding this to their pets. Cats who eat H5N1, and they have done so both by eating raw pet food that has been contaminated with it, as well as drinking raw milk in dairy barns. It is a lethal disease in cats. It causes severe neurological disease, and it's very severe. So I would recommend avoiding raw pet food altogether. It also has killed at least two dogs in Canada. So I would avoid, in general, eating raw pet food that hasn't been cooked or heated through to your pets.
By the way, we have an email from Connie who says, I live in the Lehigh Valley, the epicenter for bird flu in PA. I am very concerned that there is not enough information being shared with the public about how to prevent infection in pets, backyard flocks, and people. And we had a woman who had, we talked about this in our roundup, a woman who had chickens in her backyard. So I want to, if you have birds and you're keeping them, what should you be looking for to make sure that your birds are not infected?
To a degree, it depends on what kind of birds you have. So this is one of the many challenges with H5N1. Some birds, chickens, for example, and turkeys, H5N1 will get into your flock and it will start killing your birds very quickly, in fact. So if your chickens all start dying, if they have a lot of, they're producing a lot of foam in birds, influenza is a gastrointestinal disease, they've got diarrhea, like those are potentially some sick birds and you should call the vet and also take extreme precaution, wear respiratory protection, gloves, change your clothes before you start hugging your family members or your other pets. Now, if you raise ducks, this is one of the big challenges to controlling it. Ducks do not actually get very sick from H5N1. And this is one of the reasons why poultry farms get hit so hard, is that wild birds like ducks will come onto those poultry farms. They're flying around, they're eating, they're hanging out with the other birds, and they're giving them all H5N1, and then boom, the chickens start dying. So if people are raising ducks, they definitely need to consult, I would say, with their veterinarian to figure out if there is a testing strategy that they should be using, and they should consider using PPE just because there is so much H5N1 in wild birds. And unfortunately, wild birds fly, and we can't vaccinate them either. A vaccine was just approved for use in chickens. So that's also something that people should be talking to their vets about.
Real quick, Judy on YouTube asks, has bird flu made its way into plants or plant-based food products? Can you answer that real quick, Angie?
Yeah, no. Influenza viruses cannot infect plant cells. So no, plant-based foods are safe.
Well, thank you so much. That was so much great information.
Yes.
Obviously, there's a lot of unknowns, but it's nice to at least get the knowns out there and people can be empowered by that information. So I thank you so much. That's Angie Rasmussen with the Vaccine and Infectious Disease Organization at the University of Saskatchewan. Thanks so much for your time today on Studio 2.
It's really my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me, Avi and Cherry.
Yeah,
Thank
and let
you.
me read this comment from Akram on YouTube. This is an interesting one. Living through COVID changed my attitude toward these issues. I'm less, quote, worried and more just aware. I do what I can to avoid illness, but I don't give it space to impact my life further. It's interesting to think of the way COVID has changed the way we approach this particular issue.
Yeah, definitely impacted all of us. You don't want to scare yourself, but you want to be aware. Like, and that's what the show is all about. Also want to say thank you to our listener, Frank.
This is a good one.
Yeah, he emailed us a picture of his tattoo. It's a rooster and a hen sharing what is either a draft beer or a milkshake. It looks like it was some froth at the top.
No, it's a beer.
I would
be shocked if this is a milkshake. Frank.
Well, it had some little circles in there. I didn't know.
It looks like a classic beer pint to me. Maybe a soda.
But it's in a pint. You're right. That is a
we
pint.
Think this is maybe an orange milkshake with foam. I just, that interpretation befuddles me. But it's a great tattoo.
But it's beer with a straw. So that's what our producer is saying.
It's the chickens can't.
That's true. Yeah. They can't pick it up. They
Come
have
on,
no
guys.
Thumbs.
Let's talk about chicken no anatomy here. Do you have any tattoos?
I do.
Oh, really?
I do. I absolutely do. Yay. You know, we'll leave it there.
I don't have any, so I could just ask with impunity. I'm being very annoying at the end of the show today.
But yeah, we are going to be saying thank you. And we'll be back on the radio tomorrow. We want to say thank you to our producers.
This episode flew by, Charlie.
It did. And I hope people feel empowered when it comes to bird flu. So thank you so much to our producers, Debbie Builder, Paige Murray Bessler, Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, Al Banks, and Tina Calicay, engineered today's show with assistance from Adam Staniszewski, our executive producer is Kevin McCrory from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron.
Tattoo free.
Tattoo free. We will cluck with you tomorrow on Studio 2.